Hit Rip, the podcast continues. College basketball approaching nearly now exactly, I believe, from today, 2 months on the calendar as we record here on the 6th of September, November 6th, our opening night in college basketball. A little bit underwhelming schedule for the second consecutive year after our move to Mondays, but that's all right. We'll get to that a little bit later here in the show. But plenty to get to on this week's episode, a couple of late breaking news and notes. I know we were texting about this on the side, Brad, but at some point, the roster additions are going to have to stop. Right? We are rapidly getting to, and many schools had it this week, the add drop deadline, which didn't used to be a significant date on the college basketball calendar. But given all the late recruiting moves, you're not locked in until you're there for fall semester. And we are officially into fall semester at the vast majority of schools outside of a few out on the West Coast, Northwestern, a couple others. We saw last year with, you know, the Jose Perez's of the world. It's going to be very difficult to switch once you're there for the start of fall semester. So, obviously there's the occasional mid-year reclass, et cetera, but we're getting to the, like, this is the pool of college basketball players for this season point here very rapidly.
Well, then there's the other shoe that has to drop with all the waivers. And we need, like, a Jeff Goodman or somebody, to compile, like, the comprehensive list of guys who need a waiver. Because, you know, when you're doing these rankings, right, there's two approaches. Either you assume everybody gets a waiver or nobody gets a waiver. And when doing my rankings, I went with everybody gets a waiver because there are guys who you wouldn't think need waivers that apparently need waivers. You know, guys who, like, Jordan Brown was one who, because of his academics, supposedly needed a waiver. And there was Namari Burnett, who you would think would have to sit because he's transferred to Alabama and Texas Tech. But supposedly he's graduated, so he doesn't need a waiver. So until you get the final word, You just have to pick a side. No waivers or all waivers. I'm personally going with all waivers until told all waivers are granted until told otherwise. But that's the next real roster shoe to drop.
Yes, that and obviously things like injuries, a few academic clearance things for particularly international kids coming over. We'll get to that in a moment with Zvonimir Ivicic at Kentucky and a couple others that are potentially looming here in the next couple weeks, but. And the reporting, I believe Rothstein had it, that with fall sports athletes, so not basketball, but football, the soccer, you know, both soccer, volleyball, whatever, the two-time non-grad transfer waivers have been coming in at about 18% of the time, which is like a weird number, if only in the sense of, like, it's higher than the zero tolerance that the NCAA claims it's going to be, right? If it was truly like mental health issues and like your coach was racist, 20% is like pretty high approval. But it's also very low compared to, I think, the environment that a lot of coaches expected to encounter. And because of that, you know, I just think it's hard to really get a sense of who's gonna be out there. Obviously there's some big names at the top that we're thinking about. Namely, you look at someone like Musa Cisse at Oklahoma State, or excuse me, at Ole Miss, coming from Oklahoma State. They also have Brandon Murray in the waiver process. There's some other big names, Primo Spears, other guys leaving Georgetown second time. A lot of them are coaching change related, whether they claim to be or not. Aziz Bandego is a big one for Cincinnati. So we've got to go through some of these. But it does seem like there will be some appeals granted here for the football players in the next week or two, that might up the margins, up the success rate marginally. But I think increasingly it looks like a good percentage of the traditional two-time transfers are going to have to sit.
I still hate how all the waivers are not decided by the start of the season.
But it's insane. That's
ludicrous.
And it also comes back to my, like, real point on all this is, like, And I know someone tweeted like, oh yeah, you know, if you got rid of a waiver system, then the NCAA would get sued and there'd be all this trouble. And, you know, all these kids have sob stories, right? Every single kid has cooked up a, you know, I didn't get to do this here. You know, I was not supported properly. I wanted to be at a religious school, right? Like all these football waivers, you see them. And many of the stories are very, you know, very difficult, right? Tez Walker at North Carolina is a star wide receiver. He wants to play. His grandmother, you know, is sick. And he wants her to get to see him play at home. Things like that. But like everyone has a story, right? Like you, especially when spun properly. And if we evaluate it each individually, it's going to be so subjective. It's stupid. In my opinion, like in a working system, there would be zero waivers. There would be one time transfer. If your coach leaves, it doesn't count towards your one time transfer. Boom.
And free grad transfers.
And free grad transfers. That would be the rules. If I was the czar, if I was in charge of college basketball, that would be the rules I would have. Right, because that way, at least everyone would know what they were getting into.
And it doesn't make sense why a sob story means you get to play right away. Like, there's no real connection between that.
Correct. Right, people love to be like, oh, you know, I really wanted to be like close to my mother this year. You know, my family's been through a lot. I'm homesick. Okay, like, does that mean you should be like traveling every like twice a week to go to basketball games?
Right, and like you're gonna be living on campus and going to practice every day and stuff like.
No, like right, again, and I don't mean to sound like unsupport, like whatever. Like, there's a lot of kids that are in shitty spots. Like that's part of life, right? Like. Guys are making sacrifices, whatever. Most of the time, the decision was 90% an athletics decision. Maybe the choice between North Carolina and North Carolina State for Tez Walker, this football player who wanted to be near his grandmother, was because it's a little closer to Chapel Hill or whatever. Like marginally, maybe that's true. But like, he wasn't leaving Kent State for North Carolina because he wanted to play near his grandma. He's leaving Kent State for North Carolina because he wanted to play high major, play Power Five, get paid, right? Like, let's not like pretend that there's something else going on.
Absolutely.
So, look, we'll see what happens with these. As you said, Brad, I mean, it would be nice to have some clarity like now, right? I mean, every coach would love to know like the first day of practice, what are we doing? And the fact that we're not going to know that, really annoying, but. Looking forward to getting tweets about guys getting cleared the day before the season starts, as the NCAA does. On that front, Brad, I mentioned it just earlier ago. Svanimir Ivicic, Kentucky's unicorn big man from, I believe, Croatia, had went through the NBA draft process. So this is a really bizarre saga. Word starts leaking over the weekend that, you know, perhaps Mr. Ivicic will not get into school in time. Kentucky's ad drop date was this week. The Kentucky bloggers are all basically running with the same general story, which is that Mr. Ivicic has passed an English equivalency exam or English, you know, speaking exam, right? It's to prove that he speaks English and like will understand how to be able to take a class. And to go to Kentucky, and he's passed one of those, but he hasn't passed one that Kentucky's admissions department accepts. So Kentucky's admissions department hasn't cleared him. The bloggers are, you know, how can the school do this? How can, you know, how can they possibly hold us back? This is a basketball school. Kentucky, the university, put out like a statement about it, which was like completely wild. Like, what other school in the country is there an official like university account tweet vaguely about the whether a basketball player is going to get cleared? The statement was, unfortunately, misinformation is being perpetuated regarding the admission status of someone wishing to attend the University of Kentucky. The truth is, members of our university, from our athletic department to our administration and all other units, are working together efficiently and in a manner that is consistent with the institution's admission standards. These are often complex issues with multiple aspects to them, and they require many people working to do the right thing for an individual wishing to attend the university. This is what we're doing. Spreading unfounded rumors helps no one. this is a mess. Kentucky could really use him, particularly given the Aaron Bradshaw question mark. We're running out of time, as we said. The ad drop deadline is this week. It sounds like there might be a little bit of flexibility there, but like he's got to get here. He hasn't gone through the NCAA clearinghouse yet because he can't do that until he enrolls officially at Kentucky. That's its own set of concerns for Mr. Ivicic. But where do you stand on this, Brad? Like, is this Kentucky's athletic department being stupid or admissions department being stupid? Is this, you know, my general read on it is that there's a reason why the people putting stuff out about this are the Kentucky bloggers who are tied into like the most like we expect to be great shit of Kentucky. And I think that means that Kentucky basketball realizes this isn't going to happen, right? This doesn't get out if there's no concern, if this doesn't get out, if they're not looking to start a public pressure campaign, right? Like this is all rooted in Kentucky basketball is mad at Kentucky, the school, for not letting Mr. Ivicic into school. And now we're going to try to publicly pressure the school into getting it done. But it's a race against the clock.
Well, it's crazy because remember, they pulled this guy out of thin air. And we might forget, as you know, teams are still adding and losing guys in August and early September. But I think they added him, must have been late June or early July, which
it was the last week of July.
Last week of July. So it was very late. And for someone who it didn't seem people expected him to be a college player, they thought he'd, you know, try his hand in the NBA draft, maybe in a year or two, and maybe be a second round pick someday. But the fact that Kentucky really seems to need him, like you said, there's no backup plan. If he's out, then you say, okay, your starting front court is definitely Bradshaw and Mitchell, with Kingsley playing a lot off the bench. Bradshaw's hurt, then the only two bigs in the team are Mitchell and Kingsley.
And Kingsley's hurt.
And Kingsley's currently hurt as well.
So I polled a couple of coaches about this to make sure that my thoughts weren't unjustified. And these were coaches who were familiar with recruiting internationally. And they said, like, look, like, because my initial thought was like, yeah, like, Kentucky deserves some of the blame here, because expecting to just be able to, like, pluck a kid out of the sky who wasn't on a college radar, and more importantly, wasn't necessarily focused on being college eligible, whether that be academically, whether that be from a pro versus amateur status thing, all of those things, right? Like, trying to get that squared away in a month is not easy. There's immigration requirements. There's, you know, again, English language, admissions, like all those take time. And I don't think this will be the last story when you look around college basketball this year, with all these international kids kind of falling out of the sky here late, of kids who were not prepared to play college basketball and are now not going to get cleared in time to play this year. I think, and all those coaches agreed to that sentiment for what it was worth. UCLA, from what I've been told, has had some potential issues still with getting guys across the finish line. But UCLA had, you know, several months to a year. I mean, they have been recruiting all of these guys for a long time. There has been some knowledge of, like, this is a potential route. Let's make sure I's are dotted, D's are crossed. And I think people are underestimating the challenge that is. And because of that, I think are maybe misplacing blame on Kentucky's admissions department for being like too stringent or whatever. Like, again, I get it, right? Is one kid who doesn't really speak English probably not going to be there 4 years, like, really matter? Probably not. But like, there are rules to go to a college. There are rules to get cleared by the NCAA. There's rules by all these things. And expecting to just be able to, like, snap our fingers and get everything done is probably too much pride, too much hubris if you're a Kentucky basketball fan.
Right, and I think, you know, maybe Calipari didn't realize, because we've heard stories of, like, Rui Hachimura as a freshman at Gonzaga couldn't speak English. Yves Pons at Tennessee as a freshman couldn't speak English. But they seemingly got what needed to get done. And Kentucky, you know, being one of the top few brands in the sport, being, you know, as popular as it is, both locally and nationally, you figure that they'd be able to hand wave all the technicalities and stuff. But here we are, and if they lose Ivicic, you're gonna have to drop him down a few spots at least. I mean, he was gonna add. He could have been their best big man. I know that, you know, the three man weave guys were saying this, and I think I probably agree that we might be becoming too enamored with these international freshmen just because of the increase in number and kind of visibility here. When I think our track record shows the guys like the Yves Pons and the Rui Hachimuras and, you know, all these Gonzaga guys, you know, they all need time, you know, before they're great college basketball players. But you figure he was their best big man and borderline top 100 player in the sport and with a second round NBA draft pick potentially. And, you know, if you lose that guy and you got to move in an injured Bradshaw or an injured Kingsley, you're going to be, you got to take a hit in the rankings.
Yeah, I probably had a lower view on Ivicic to begin with. I thought it was a backup behind Mitchell and Bradshaw if those guys were healthy, and then he was going to compete with Onyenso for the backup center spot. But there's a depth thing. There's, you know, upside, talent, like all those things come into play with Ivicic, and I think it's enough to it would be a notable loss. I think the only potential benefit would be that it would force John Calipari, particularly if some of these injuries continue to nag for Bradshaw and Onyenso, to play smaller, right? Play Trey Mitchell at the five, play Justin Edwards or Adu Thiero at the four, play three guards, really space it out and have multiple playmakers, multiple shot makers on the floor. I think that's the Kentucky we saw in Canada. That's the Kentucky that opened eyes overseas. And I do hope that we get to see that, whether or not Zvonimir Ivicic is there. But I do think there's maybe some slight potential of benefit for Mr. Calipari if Ivicic can't go, just because it forces him to it takes the ball out of his hand and forces him to play smaller.
I mean, for the record, I want every single player to be eligible.
Yes. Right?
Personally rooting, whether it be waiver or international or academic or whatever, I want the most talent possible retained in college basketball.
Yep.
But if you're going to discuss it, you got to discuss it logically, or else what are we even doing here?
Correct. Well, as I was saying, can be difficult with international kids, lots to get through. With high school kids who are always on a college path and always kind of in the potential mix to reclassify these days, it could be done very quickly. And Providence may have just sealed the fastest recruitment in the history of recruiting. So my understanding is the timeline. Sunday night, Will McNair, who is the backup center at Providence, transfer from Mississippi State, comes in, tells Kim English, look, I think I want to transfer. I want more minutes. You know, I'm going to be the backup center here. I want to play. I'm a grad. I can do what I want. Kim says, okay. Mr. McNair enters the transfer portal officially on Tuesday. Sunday night, the wheels go into motion for Providence to try to bring in Eli Delorier, who is a 2024 high school big man, was on a true high major trajectory, was being recruited by a lot of SEC schools early on, had a bad summer, was set to visit Loyola Chicago this coming weekend. Providence basically says, like, pack your bags and come visit. Now, mind you, Providence's ad drop deadline is Wednesday. We're recording this pod here on Wednesday. He visits Monday and Tuesday. He commits Tuesday night. And on Wednesday, he announces he's a Providence Friar. So congratulations to Mr. Delorier for the honor of fastest recruitment ever. Whether he's ready to
contribute this year, given the fact that, again, he was likely to visit an A-10 school as a 2024 kid at this point last week. I think that's an open question. But he does have some pedigree. He's very skilled. And if nothing else, he is a, you know, break the glass ceiling, you know, in case of emergency, big man for Kim English to go along with Josh Aduro and Rafael Castro for the Friars in 2023.
Dude, if your center leaves on, and you're saying it was actually September, what, 3rd?
Yeah.
If your center leaves on September 3rd, you take any center you can get. Anyone with a pulse is welcome. There is no questioning that. I mean, that is an unmitigated disaster. And now, Brendan McGair, who is one of the Providence beat writers, he's the best of the three beat writers, and he does a great job. In his article, he was saying that McNair has to sit the first semester and might need a waiver for the second semester. I'm assuming he's getting that from the Providence side. But if that's the case, like, what on earth is Will McNair doing? Like, he's going to, like, okay, he's from Philadelphia. Maybe he goes to, like, LaSalle or, like, I mean, I think it would be hilarious if he goes to Georgetown, personally. that would be perfect.
I want to watch the world burn.
Let's say he goes to LaSalle, right? And now he can't play until mid-December. I guess it's worth playing, you know, a couple non-league games and 18 A-10 games at 25 minutes a game versus playing 30-plus Providence games at 13 minutes a game. I guess, but, I mean, to do this so late doesn't make any sense for any party.
Particularly because it doesn't seem like he had a bad international trip. Like, I know we only have stats, but it's not like when McNair didn't play.
He played more than Castro, it seems.
Right. Like he was clearly in the role that he was anticipated to be in. I'm not convinced that he won't be able to play right away if he can enroll in time. I just don't know where it is and, like, who tampered, right? Like,
Gonzaga needs a big. Kentucky needs a big. Who knows?
But again, all those are for backup spots.
Right, but bigger brand and presumably bigger NIL.
True.
But hey, listen. I've been one of the very first Rafael Castro stockholders from the inner squad scrimmage last October. I've held on to this for over, you know, almost 11 months at this point. And from the flashes he showed as a redshirt freshman, he's good enough to be a backup center. He should have been the backup center last year over Clifton Moore. He's plenty good enough. This is going to hurt Providence defensively because they don't have another, obviously, 7-foot, 260-pound dude to hit people. It's going to make them more susceptible in the bye games because you can't just overwhelm people with your size. You know, they've gone from a team that was pretty big. It's kind of a normally sized high major team. You can't, you know, bail yourself out against Sacred Heart by playing Hop, Oduro, and McNair 3-4-5 and just crushing on the glass. And I think defensively he was probably a better option than Oduro. But then on the other hand, like, Oduro is going to play, you know, what, 27 minutes a game, probably, right? He was 13 minutes, probably. Maybe 15, 16, you get a couple minutes with him and Aduro together. But for a guy in his sixth year to never start and be on all these good basketball, I mean, I can see it from that perspective. But
it just seems like something he should have decided in June when this decision.
Or even after the trip, right? The trip ended on, I think, August 25th, 26th. So I guess he waited like a week or so, but.
Yeah. So this might be a sleepers media segment. This is not a negative way, but we know the sleepers love to overreact. We encourage you all to check out their show on YouTube every day. They love to overreact to things. I have a overreaction that I've seen a little bit of online, and I think there is some truth to. I'm going to let Brad have his say on it, whatever. Kim English's recruiting at Providence is officially a little underwhelming, is the take. So Kim English will bring in 4 freshmen this year. Garway Jewell, who was committed to Providence under Ed Cooley, did not sign. We've already done the debate whether Kim was Garway or Kim wasn't Garway. But he had some involvement. And then 3 other freshmen, Rich Barron, Donovan Santoro, who was committed under Cooley, and then Eli Delorier. In 2024, his Delorier, 3-star kid, you know, kind of fringe. 2024, he has 2 other commitments, Ryan Mila from Middlesex Magic, really only his only high major offer to Providence, and then Daquan Davis, who is a good recruit, point guard, top 150-ish kid. And so I think the narrative would be, okay, this is a probably downward step on the aggregate talent-wise from what Cooley was recruiting. Cooley also, basically, one of the reasons he was theoretically leaving Providence was he wanted to get the elite kids, right? He could get a visit from like a Taylor Bull Bowen, like a top 40 type kid. Couldn't usually finish the job. Bryce Hopkins, actually a good example of this. Couldn't usually get it across the finish line at Providence. And I guess the question was Kim English in a position to change that? Kim is, I think, a dynamite recruiter with how he is with people. I think Kim has proven that if he invests all of his time in recruiting a kid, he has a real chance to get him, right? You got Justin Fernandez, the top 100 kid at VCU, or at George Mason, excuse me. Invested a ton of resources into Garway, right? Like, I think Kim has proven, and this is probably too measured to take for this topic, but I think Kim has proven that, like, if Kim really wants a kid, Kim will get a kid, or have a really good chance to get a kid. But I do think on the aggregate, you look at, like, the talent that he's brought in, and you say, especially once Oduro is leaving, this feels a little underwhelming.
Okay, so we'll start with the defensive game, Kim English. Because I have thoughts on both sides of the ledger here. We'll start with the defensive Kim English, right? You look at this team as for 23-24, as it's currently constructed, right? Now, obviously, with Will McNair, they had a good, like, veteran group of 9, really good guys, right? A great top 9. And then, obviously, Justin Fernandez is hurt. Rich Barron's got some, you know, nice preseason buzz. So, I mean, the fact that you add Donovan Santoro and Eli Delorier to be 12 and 13, like, who cares? Those spots turnover anyway. But you lose McNair, so everybody slides up one, right? I still think that this top 8 and then Rich Barron at number 9 is really good. I still think that this could be a top 25 team. As I was saying earlier, you lose some of your defense, you lose a little bit of your versatility. But at the end of the day, McNair was probably 8th in the rotation. Castro goes from 9 to 8. I think we're good to go here. In terms of the recruiting, what are you expecting him to add, right? Like, we just went through, I think everyone can agree that this top 8, top 9 with McNair was very good, right? All the concerns with the ranking stem from Kim English coach, right? So when most of the freshmen are signed anyway, how did you want him to fill out the back of the roster, right? That doesn't, like, who are these mythical great recruits that want to be the 10th, 11th, 12th man of Providence?
Right. So I think the take is, you're right about 2023. But I think there is a feeling of, okay, maybe I wanted a little more in 2024 so far. And you count Delorier as kind of like a bridge between those two. And you look and you say, yes, this is the last year of Oduro. Yes, this is the last year of Ticket. Yes, there's a good chance this is the last year of B-Hop.
And Garway, potentially, right?
Potential one and done Garway.
But now let's move to 24-25, right? And now they still have visits coming up. They got a 3-star big, who I'm not sure. I wouldn't think he and Delorier would cancel each other out, but Mitchell Holmes visiting, I think the 23rd. Isaiah Elohim, who's a top 50 guy right now, might be moving down, but probably still a top 100 guy. He's visiting the weekend after that. And they're trying to get a visit from Carter Knox, which we'll talk about later as on the negative side.
So I guess that's the thing, right? Like Kim can sign one big name kid, whether they can get Carter Knox, I assume they can't, right? Whether they can get Isaiah Elohim, maybe they can because he's falling, right? If he can sign one big name kid in 2024, the fears kind of evaporate, right? Like,
right, because then you look at this 24-25 roster, right? Because, okay, let's say Devin Carter is back, which we'll see what the NIL package is, right? So Devin Carter as a senior, after averaging 13 points per game as a sophomore, that's a fine, that's a good best player. Jaden Pierre and Corey Floyd are very good. We saw them flashes last year. They were good recruits. They took a normal step forward this year with more minutes than as juniors in 24-25. That's a very good starting backcourt. That's probably an excellent starting 1-3. You need one or two front court transfers. You have Castro, you have Justin Fernandez, and then you have a good veteran group again. Daquan Davis as a top 100 recruit as a backup point guard, that's fine, right? The Mela, Santoro, Barron, Delorier, I mean, two of those guys might not even be there in 24-25, right? The way that these rosters have been turning over, and if they are, it probably means that they showed something to stick around.
No question. And look, again, there are some like circumstantial things that have played against Kim here, right? Like Delorier was not his first choice. He was probably not taking Delorier in 2024. Right, the fact like you would never reclass a kid who you're not sure is good enough for the previous class, right?
And no, there's a pulse. It's September.
Correct. That's what I'm saying. If this was in June though, they're never taking Eli Delorier for 2023. We had to get it done.
And now let's move to the negative side of the Kim English so far, right? This whole, we'll call it a fiasco. It started in April or March when they were trying to get Graham Ike. That never made any sense at all. The reigning Mountain West Player of the Year, who is currently injured, was going to sign up to be a backup to Josh Aduro? And if they were going to start together, then like, what's this whole, modern offense? No, you'd be playing the flex. That doesn't make any sense. That didn't make any sense at all. And who knows how much time and resources they went after him. But at least publicly, they didn't start contacting other bigs until he was off to Gonzaga. So that just puts you behind the eight ball, because instead of getting a more realistic target, then, you got outbid for Lance Ware, what's going to happen, And then there was just, I don't even remember all the guys at this point, but there were like four or five different guys before they landed on McNair. And then, you sign up a guy who signed up for his last year of eligibility to be a backup center. It seemed like it worked until he pulls the plug, right, and wants more playing time. Whereas, like, if you really wanted that big, and it's April, maybe you get someone more reasonable who, like how Xavier got like a Logan Duncan. Now, I don't think that was a great ad for Xavier, but what if Kim really wanted like a bigger center and you said, okay, Logan, you're not going to play much this year, but then Josh is gone and, you can be the starter as a senior or whatever. That's the type of guy who they needed, who you could sell that second year to. Instead, they shot way too high. And I think that's what's going on with Carter Knox here as well, where like, do we really think they're going to beat out Kentucky and Louisville in the G League and Florida State and all these teams who we had previous connections to? They're going to come in late and land you know, the second or third highest recruit in province history, that just feels like a waste. And people are applauding Kim for shooting high with him and, you know, offering Cooper Flag and, you know, this guy, that guy, you know, actually trying to recruit these five stars. Well, you know, Cooley's not dumb, right? Cooley's a great recruiter. Cooley, and I think Providence fans rightfully so, really hit him hard with this very same thing, where he didn't really have a grasp, it seemed like, on which recruits he could get. Like, I mean, early in his tenure, he was trying, you know, he was in the top five for James Young and all, and the fans like, oh my God, he made a top list and everything. But like, as it goes on and you're wasting time on like Jaquan Lyle and Hunter Dickinson and all these guys who like, and Lance Ware the first time, like, everyone knows that you have no shot at landing this guy except for you. Like, you're wasting your time that could be spent on other guys.
Yeah. So,
go on, sorry.
Yeah, so on that point, and then I think we can wrap on the Providence discussion, unless we want to rename this as Friar Central. Look, Kim English is as in tune with what people are saying about him and what things he does, and the way that things he does will resonate with people as any coach in America. And he is unbelievably calculated, right? And sometimes I think to a detriment. I think, as you said, I think there is a certain level of Kim, whether it's an ego thing, whether it's a, you know, does he think he's going to land his kids? I don't know. But he believes, whether it's for his own ego or for, you know, to prove to people, right, like that he can do it, whatever, he feels obligated to go out and try to recruit Cooper Flag, try to recruit Carter Knox, whatever. And look, like, Kim is not just, like, offering Cooper Flag. I was at the Peach Jam. Kim English was at every Cooper Flag game. And let me tell you, there's no one else on Maine United anywhere close to good enough. Ace Flag cannot play at Providence. If Providence takes Ace Flag, they're idiots. Landon Clark is like a low major player. Unless Kim is really recruiting Tegan Pelletier to be his walk-on, preferred walk-on point guard, that he spent, you know, 3 hours a day, give or take, while at the Peach Jam, wasting time following Cooper Flag around to, like, maybe get an official visit, right? Like, Cooper Flag going to go to Duke. If he doesn't go to Duke, he's probably going to UConn. If he doesn't go to UConn, he's probably going to go to the G League, right? Like, there's no world where Providence gets Cooper Flag. There is almost no world where they get Carter Knox. Maybe they can get Isaiah Elohim. Maybe they can get, like, right? Like, maybe they can ride the wave of a kid coming up, right? Like Garway is a good example of this, right? Like, Providence jumped in early on Garway, right as his stock ascended. They pushed for an early visit, an early commitment. They got it done. And then he turned into a top 50 recruit. That's the easiest route to getting that type of kid at Providence, right?
Maybe. I mean, they can get Elohim, I think.
Yes.
Carter Knox, I wouldn't think so, but I guess if he's visiting, feels like a waste of time, but who knows. Right. And for Cooper Flag, I mean, sure seems like that was the most fun way to spend Peach Jam.
Believe me. Watches games. I did the same thing. So I can't blame you. But no, I do think there is a lot to be said for Kim being like, ooh, what can I do to excite people? What can I do to prove to people what I do? Right? Like, and Landon Gramike would have been a great prove it, right? Like, hey, look, I'm an elite recruiter. I can get one of the best transfers in the country to come play for me, even if we don't even need him. Right? But I do think, as a coach, like, you have to be very calculated about, like, building the right team, especially in the NIL era, right? Like, if Providence had used a bunch of NIL resources to get Gramike and then been a guard short, it'd be the stupidest thing ever, right? If Providence is going to recruit under Kim certain guys just to say that they recruited certain guys, it's a recipe for disaster. So I guess that was my closing thought on Providence. again, if they can get like an Elohim or something like that done, that'll help this class quite a bit. Daquan Davis is very good. Ryan Mila, I think, is a chance, but they have added up a few of these guys who are like real fringe high major players, right? I think all three of Barron, Santoro, and Delorier are very fringe high major players. Maybe Barron, you need at least one of those guys to turn into something, because if not, you're just cycling through scholarships. So
that's my most teams cycle through that two or three stars at the end of the bench anyway. Those guys used to be like productive high major players. Now they're just loading up for the A-10s and the CAAs of the world.
I think the only thing I would say just to bounce off of that is people have been spoiled by the COVID year, and the combination now of everyone needing to afford transfers being much more expensive than high school players, and running out of transfers with the COVID year wrapping up in a year. I do think those spots are becoming a lot more important, right? Like, you're not going to be able to just whiff on 9 through 13 every year and cycle them through, because you're going to need to have some player development. You're not going to be able to get 6-7 guys in the spring.
And my, I guess, heuristic for evaluating a recruiting class for a place like Providence, right? I think you're on target if every class you can get a top 50 recruit, a top 100 recruit, and then one or two 3-stars.
Yep.
I think you'll be in great shape. You'll have top 25 teams and all that. Yep. If you can get that. So.
Agreed.
We'll see.
All right. We promised some bold predictions. I don't know if these are bold predictions as much as they are talking points, but I have some stuff I want to get off my chest, some things I've been thinking about. I've been working on my annual ranking every team in college basketball. So I've got some takes. Now, the first take, Brad, and this is not necessarily related to ranking things, but I do think we can fit it into the bold predictions category, because there is some future stuff, as you mentioned on social media here, and we'll get to that in a second. Scheduling the first night and the first week in particular of the college basketball season sucks. It sucked last year. Everyone kind of blamed it on, we changed things last second. We moved to Monday, election day, midterms, yada, yada, yada. Well, we had more time to prepare this year, and it sucks again. John Rothstein tweeted something today about the schedule. I'll see if I can find the list. But he said, here's the 5 best games of opening night. Those games on opening night were Princeton versus Rutgers and Trenton, Alabama versus Morehead State, Bellarmine versus Washington, Oregon and Georgia in Las Vegas, and USC and Kansas State also in Las Vegas. So that's horrible, right? That's 2 high major games. One of them is, one of them is against a potential 2 non-tournament teams in Oregon and Georgia. The other one, USC, Kansas State, is pretty good. But I don't think it's like a game that like has national huge appeal, right? Like, no, like, other than the diehards, no like casual college basketball fan, particularly without Bronny, if Bronny doesn't play, assuming Bronny's not gonna be there. Like, no one is going to look up and be like, oh my god, USC versus Kansas State, Arthur Kaluma versus Boogie Ellis, what a game. So we have a scheduling problem. Now, as you alluded to on social media and Twitter or X, whatever we call it nowadays, there's been discussion that the Gavitt Games renewal will come as a first week product. I think that would be great. I would go as far as to, and if we want to use it to start our bold predictions, I would go as far as in the next 5 years, we will have a pretty substantial slate of opening week games. I don't know about opening night, but opening week games, whether it be from the Gavitt Games or other properties, particularly those owned by ESPN competitors, so Fox, potentially NBC. I could see Peacock making a play to have opening week Big Ten conference games, things like that. But, there's lots of people out to blame. ESPN is one of them. ESPN is certainly not the only one, but the schedule sucks. So my bull prediction is that we'll get better. But for now, I mean, we're as I tweeted, I think we're soft launching the college basketball season.
Right. And the thing I don't understand, right? People, oh, it's early in the season. Like, that's not a reason. It doesn't even make any sense. It's early in the season for everybody. if Duke plays Kansas on opening night, it's early in the season for Duke and early in the season for Kansas. And that the result of that game, like, I think you put it on Twitter, like, that's not going to get John Shire fired. Obviously not going to get Bill Self fired. They'll fall from, like, 5th to 10th in the AP poll if they lose. And then when they rattle off a few bye games and somebody loses in their Thanksgiving tournament, they'll be back up at 5 before you know it anyway. Like, it's just a lack of – it's a lack of leadership, a lack of foresight. Someone's got to be like, hey, you know – okay, even on a Monday Night Football, like, we can – we'll put on Fox at 6:30 and 8:30, or we can put it on ESPN – you or something as another option, you know, counter programming the Monday Night Football or something. But there's no way that we can just continue on with telling ourselves that we're going to watch the Fox Sports whip around the 10 Big East bye games, which fucking sucks. I watched that for the first time last year because Providence wasn't playing on opening night. They were playing on the second night. And that whip around coverage was disgusting. I was like, this is atrocious. So games are going on, and they're talking to the freaking guys in the studio, Casey Jacobson and whoever.
So I guess the best illustration of, like, does week one matter, or why it doesn't matter, right? Like if you play a big,
what are all these secret scrimmages for?
Correct.
You have to be ready for opening night.
So it doesn't, like, again, it doesn't matter what happens if you lose open. But for the vast majority of high major teams, you play a big time game, it wouldn't matter. Remember last year, last year, first Sunday of the year, so 6 days into the season, Tennessee played a standalone game against Colorado in Nashville and got worked, like run out the gym in the second half. And for like 2 days, oh my gosh, Tennessee not so good. Guess where Tennessee started the year last year in KenPom? 4th. Guess where they finished the regular season? Last day of the regular season, March 4th. Guess where they were ranked?
4th.
4th. It doesn't matter. Like, and again, the fact that Illinois is willing, or Kansas is willing to go play at Illinois the week before the season with fans in attendance on national television, in a quote-unquote exhibition for charity, but wouldn't play them November 6th. It's absurd. Arkansas and Purdue. We can play a week before. Can't do it during the season. Heck, these teams are playing on-campus games. This is what every college basketball fan wants. Every single college basketball fan in America would love to watch Arkansas-Purdue in Fayetteville. Illinois and Kansas in Champaign. Tennessee versus Michigan State in East Lansing. Those games all came together in like a snap of the fingers. But instead, whether it be because of event company involvement, TV company involvement, scared coaches, lack of leadership, all those things top to bottom, all those games get played off campus, if they do get played at all. None of them get played opening week because, God forbid Illinois not get to play Eastern Illinois on opening night. How will we ever survive? Brad Underwood's going to get fired if he plays Kansas on opening night. Like, what are we doing? Just play the games.
And how about if it's a getting ready thing from the coaches, why don't we make the concession and add a third preseason game? So you can go beat up on the D2 school from down the street extra time. You know, if it's, oh, I'm losing a home game because I have to go play at Tennessee on opening night. Okay, well, you can go host Illinois Town X that has 2,000 students, sub school or whatever, and play them. Make, you know, I don't know, but it, like, you know, what do we like? We can't sit here and honestly say that coaches are going to get fired, the teams are going to be exposed when it's the same date on the calendar for both teams. that they can't prepare when they have all these months of offseason and stuff.
Like, and every single coach, after they play a big game, you go into the press room after the Champions Classic. I was there last year. I'll be there again this year. Every single coach goes in that room, no matter the result, right? Kentucky lost a heartbreaking game. John Calipari walked in that press room. Wonder what he said? He said, this game will be an incredible experience for us to learn from. There's a lot we can gain from playing a game like this in a great atmosphere against some of the best coaches and best players in the country, highly competitive overtime game. We will learn from this. John Shire walked in the press room after they lost a heartbreaker to Kansas and said, our freshmen will learn from this game. Right? You will learn about your team when you play these games. You grow, right? Your players are up for it. How is this not how is it not so easy to get this done? I don't understand. But anyway, that's my thoughts on scheduling. Hopefully it gets better soon. I believe it will.
Sure hope so. For something I wanted to kind of throw out there. Now, this might be a little hypocritical, because in my rankings, I do not have this team in the NCAA tournament. I have them just outside. But I think that this year's version of Kansas State or Northwestern, I think it could be Vanderbilt.
Hmm.
Now, the SEC, which I think is the best conference this year, that strength could hurt or could harm or help them, given they could stack up too many losses, but on the other hand, they have a lot more opportunities. But the fact that all we hear is that Jerry Stackhouse is such a good coach, they've had these injury issues, these contacts, things that have held them back. But like last year, they were pretty good down the stretch. Like they were winning a ton of games. I know that their overall metrics were still pretty low, I think, but I mean they were looking good there. They were winning a ton of games. They seemed to come along. And they're bringing three starters back. I know that they're losing Liam Robbins, right? But Tyron Lawrence has got to be like a top 100 player in the sport, right? Like he was a G League combine guy. He had a great year. So the three starters plus Van Allen Lubin, who people were raving about all preseason last year. Like this offense should be pretty good. They have a lot of options here.
Who's the third starter?
Colin Smith, Tyron Lawrence, and Ezra Manion, right?
Colin Smith, okay. Yeah. I had Colin off the bench. I guess he started some down the stretch, you're right.
So I'm kind of betting on what everyone says. You know, like with these rankings, there are some incongruities, right? With like three-man weave has Villanova 17th, and they don't have Providence in the top 40. Like there's not 25 spots between them in terms of just roster, right? So, like, you're saying Kim English is, like, an absolute trash can head coach because we know – I mean, no one thinks Kyle Neptune's a good coach. But everyone is saying Jerry Stackhouse is an amazing coach, X and O and everything. And we haven't really seen that bump yet. And I wonder if – now that they have some continuity, they have some good players back. This could be the year.
Yeah, I think there's a lot to be said, like vibes wise with this whole thing, right? Like the vibes at Vanderbilt were really bad this offseason. At one point, right? And it kind of got fixed once Tyron came and then Ben Allen Lubin committed. But there was that point where it's like, okay, like we have Ezra Mignon, we have Evan Taylor, we have Colin Smith, and that's it. And they kind of pieced it together late. I actually think the same could kind of be said for Michigan. Like Michigan had such a bad vibes offseason that, like, sometimes you can miss the forest for the trees. And, like, oh, yeah, like, this isn't that bad a roster. Like I know we talked about it a couple weeks ago, like, Freeman, we've put him top 40. I'm not there. But, like, if you talked about – if you just, like, read what people said about Michigan and about Juwan Howard this spring, you would have thought that Michigan was staring down, like, a 12-20.
Right. It's just their roster is weird, but, like – Olivier Nakamwa's really good. They got some good young players like
Doug McDaniel, Terrace Reed.
Right, there's definitely a path where this just works out and they're just like a fine NCAA tournament team.
Right. And I think you're probably right about Vanderbilt being like if you just took stock of it now, you'd say, yeah, that's probably a pretty good team. probably like postseason team. Probably not on paper tournament team, but could get there. I want to see a full year with Stack. It feels like they've caught a rush a few times and really rolled like they did down the stretch last year. But I don't know that it's been – we haven't yet gotten a full season where like, yeah, that was great from Stack. So is Mignon, Lawrence, Taylor, Smith, and Lubin the lineup we get? Do we see more of Lubin at the four, Lee Dort at the five? They also have the kid from South Dakota, Tassos Tomateros, who's like a stretch big. And then a lot of like rolled dice freshmen and sophomores in the back half of the bench. So I think that's like a worthwhile take to log.
Now you were saying in terms of vibes, like Vanderbilt and Michigan were down in terms of vibes. Who are the inverse, you think? Teams that like the vibes were pretty good, but like when we step back, we're like, wait a second, this team's not that good.
I think the first one, my first answer to that would be Georgia.
Georgia was definitely mine last year.
Georgia had the same thing this year. We never fell for it, Brad. But Georgia had some real buzz.
It just hit a bunch of singles. And then you look up and you're like, wait a second. Your best player is Noah Thomason? Like, hold on.
Right. No. Right. Sometimes you just you add enough players where people are like, oh yeah, like they're doing a lot, but where did they actually move the needle? Like, where's the talent? That's the reasonable question. I'm trying to think of another team, like vibes wise, good.
For me, it's NC State.
It's a good answer.
Where like, you know, they needed to add, you know, a lot of veteran talent here, and they get the two bigs, Middlebrooks and DR, they get MJ Rice, who's a great roll of dice. They get Jaden Taylor and DJ Horn. And you're like, okay, now I can see it. Then, like, you take a step back and you're like, okay, Casey Morcell is your best player. Are we sure Jaden Taylor is actually, like, an ACC-level starter? Like, Butler was horrible last year. DJ Horn, okay, like, but, like, the sum of these parts, like, this I don't think is a tournament team anymore. I think when the pieces were accumulating, I was thinking, okay, NC State's reloading. They'll be pretty good again.
I would say the only other one I would say, and this is more like a fan disconnect, would be West Virginia. I don't know what the vibes are like nationally, you would say, with West Virginia. But I do think there's like a real like, oh my God, this is a great roster. And we both agree, like, this is not a great roster.
No, it is not even a good roster.
But yeah, I think the root of it really is, who did a lot in like April and early May and who didn't do a lot in April and early May? Like Michigan had a very negative April and early May and then kind of like fixed it late. And like you looked around and you're like, okay, it's actually okay. Vanderbilt fixed it late, right? Team like that, like the narrative was already set. Texas actually kind of saved it to a point where people are just fine. I'm actually kind of still down on Texas, but that's more that like, I never really liked Ace Smith as a high major guy. Like, I think he'll be good. I also think he'll be great. I don't know how healthy Disu is. I don't know who they're playing at the three. And I think they took some like weird rolls of the dice on the back half of the roster. But I still think Texas is like a tournament team. I still think they're like a top 25 team, which I think a lot of people have them at now.
Oh, I want to touch on Texas later because I'm all in on Texas. But just two other teams, actually from the Big 12, but I think the vibes aren't matching the roster, are Cincinnati and Kansas State. Similar to what you were saying, like Cincinnati, they add C.J. Frederick, Seamus Lukosius, Bandego, Reynolds. But then, like, you look up and it's like, if Bandego and Reynolds don't get waivers, like, I don't know. Like, it's the best play. I mean, you know, it's the same question for a lot of these teams. Where it's like, C.J. Frederick, starter. I guess that's okay, but then you pilot it with like Odiaguama starter and Davion Thomas starter, and you're like, this is getting not as a sure thing as we thought. Yeah.
I think that gets to the point though that we've tried to make all throughout the offseason. I think it's easier once everything's on paper. I think it really gets to the point that it is incredibly, incredibly difficult to build a very legit roster mostly in 1 year of portal guys, right?
Right.
you can get to respectability very quickly. And there will be one or two teams every year that that like respectable roster really takes off, right? Like
Missouri. Yeah.
Right. Missouri last year, Iowa State 2 years ago, randomly like Isaiah Brockington becoming incredible, right? Like things like that. Those things do happen. But you are going to look around at most teams that are starting four transfers, starting four or five transfers, and saying like, that's a lot of fifth best players, right? Like if you're buying Texas Tech this year, you're not buying it because Joe Toussaint, Darian Williams, Devin Cambridge, and Warren Washington are great starters. You're buying it because of Pop Isaac's stability and coaching, right? That roster is not like overwhelmingly good by any means, right? Like, I mean, Oklahoma, if you're buying Oklahoma, you're buying a big Javion McCollum year and a big Milos Uzan year. You're not buying it like, oh man, like we just stack Latrae Darthard and John Hughley and we're going to be great. Like that's not. And again, I'm just looking at Big 12 depth charts. Same thing with Cincinnati, right? Like Cincinnati has a lot of good players. Like I like Ravon Griffith a lot. And I think Lukosius is a good starter. I think Frederick's a starter. I think Lockin's a starter. I think Bendigo's a starter. But if your best player is Seamus Lukosius or Victor Lockin, you're probably not that good.
Exactly. So we have a bunch of teams like that. And did you have any? Oh, you went with a Michigan, right? For like the Kansas State or Northwestern of this year.
Yeah, I'm not even sure that I'm like overly in, but like I think there are similar teams to Vanderbilt, and I'm trying to think of if I have another one that would be. I mean, so Stanford or Washington would be big, like Northwestern, like hot seat, save it vibes. And I think both have like some reason for optimism.
I guess probably my biggest hot seat save it guy is Mike Boynton, I think.
That's fair.
No, but I mean, Stanford has all these shooters. I mean, it just comes down to Jared Bynum again. He's the continuous X factor.
Stanford's going to be like on the bubble in early February. They're going to play like Oregon. They're going to play Washington State on the road. They're going to be like 2-point favorites on the road. And you're going to watch this game at like 10 o'clock at night on ESPNU. And you're going to text me like all caps, ha, 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 when Jared Bynum turns it over for the sixth time and loses them the game.
Yeah, where he shoots like 2 for 12 and then gets like murdered on defense. Yeah.
No, Oklahoma State's a good one. I think they have a chance to be pretty good. I will say, if you were grading like important, like if you were hunting, maybe this is a list we could do another show, like most important transfers outside of like the top names, right? Like obviously Hunter Dickinson's a very important transfer, right?
But sneaky impact transfers.
Sneaky, like this guy has to be really good for this team to be really good. And for Oklahoma State, it could be Mike Boynton's job. I think Javon Small at Oklahoma State is probably on that list. And he's just one of those guys that was like irrelevant because of circumstance, right? Like Javon Small was
East Carolina.
Yeah. He's not on an overly relevant team. He didn't have a big freshman year, so he got nothing. He averaged 2 points a game as a freshman. But he goes to East Carolina. He has a half year because of injuries. But he averages 16, 5, and 6. On like not the worst efficiency on that East Carolina team. And just kind of slides under the radar. Like, do you remember like a Javon Small recruitment? I mean, I knew who he was. I had watched him play.
No, I mean, there's just so many transfers. Right. It's like, I was thinking earlier, like the whole like Eric Musselman thing was like, oh, we reach out to all the transfers and we have like this proprietary algorithm that will tell us what'll translate up to the SEC and not. And now it's like there's a million, like as you were saying, like good starter, like fifth starter, fourth starter level guys everywhere for like every team to choose from with the COVID years, that if you were making a top 100 transfer list, the guy 21 and 82 might be in the same tier.
Yes. Agreed. But yeah, just so people are aware, Javon Small's last game before getting injured and shut down for the year, he had 23 points, 4 rebounds, and 5 assists against Cincinnati. In a game that they lost 83-55, to give you a sense of the lack of talent around him. He scored an efficient 23 points, 5 assists, and his team lost by 28.
I'm looking through Big East rosters now to try to come up with a sneaky transfer. I think where I'm leaning right now, I have a few more teams to click through here. I think I'm leaning Abu Usman.
It's a good one.
Like, he has to anchor this defense. Like, this defense could be like an absolute tire fire. But offensively, they're going to be incredible, no matter what happens with Abu Usman. But like, if they want to hold on defensively, but
agreed. Yeah,
maybe that's a full list for another time or something.
Yes,
like eight or ten guys.
So I have a hot take, or maybe bold prediction. I guess that's the theme of our show. My bold prediction is that Cal plays in the NCAA tournament or NIT this year.
Okay.
I also think adjacent to that take, if Cal goes from 3-29 and 270th in KenPom to playing in the postseason this year, Mark Madsen should be national coach of the year.
That's fair. I mean, like, people don't really think of Cal as being so bad because did they win their game prior to Louisville too? Like, was Louisville the last one or I'm trying to remember from last year.
I believe so. So Cal's first win of the year, actually no, Louisville won first. Cal didn't win until December 21st against UT Arlington and won by 21 points, 22 points, excuse me.
Which is hilarious.
And then they randomly won 3 of 4. They beat UT Arlington. They lost to Utah. They beat Colorado and Stanford at home. They beat Stanford by 22.
They lost the rest of the games?
Correct.
Oh, my God.
But, yeah, Cal's roster's not that bad. The only thing that they don't really have is, like, a traditional point guard. They have Jalen Cohn and Devin Askew, both of whom are, like, kind of more scorers. Yep. But they have Jalen Tyson, who I have been told looks really good. He still needs a waiver officially, but should get it. Fardaws is a really good big. I've been told he's down. He played at about 270, 280 last year at Texas Tech. He's down to 245. Great shape.
He didn't look great last year.
No.
He looks heavy.
Yes.
I mean, this is really your Northwestern Kansas State of the year then. I guess you're not totally in on them making the tournament, but
right. I'm hedging because I just don't know how talented this team is. Again, it's the same thing, right? Like, it's all transfers, right? Jalen Tyson is as good probably a player as you can probably get, just because, especially at Cal. But it was circumstance with, you know, the racism thing and his relationship with Matt Strabinsky, the assistant coach at Texas Tech, who came over to Cal with Madsen. But yeah, like I kind of think Cal is gonna Cal will surpass its win total from last year before Thanksgiving, I believe.
Sounds about right, right? When you're
Cal's opening schedule, it's manageable. They play St. Thomas opening night, then they play Pacific, then they play Cal State Bakersfield. They win all three of those games. They've matched their win total. November 16th, 10 days into the season, they played Montana State. They win that game. They've topped their win total. They then play in their MTE. They play Bradley, UTEP, and Tulane, two of the three. Probably favored in all three of those games. So even if they lose to San Diego State that weekend, even if they lose, you got to split Santa Clara and Butler the next week. They get Ole Miss in San Antonio, then they get UC San Diego. Like, they're gonna go like 8-3 in the non-con.
I think personally, in terms of the Pac-12, I think I have 10th, just ahead of Arizona State and Oregon State.
I'm buying the Madsen thing, man. I don't know.
I mean, he just did a great job at a Utah Valley. I mean, right.
He did such a great job. They've got a good team. Like, the roster is not – I think they're more talented than, like, Washington State. More talented than Utah, I think.
Utah, definitely. Washington State, let me
– Unless you're really buying – I guess you're a big Yesufu guy.
I'm a big Yesufu stat guy. I'm not sure if I'm a big Yesufu impact guy. Yeah, I think they're probably more talented than Washington State. Washington State has all the money ball guys, though. Like Isaac Jones, Jalen Wells, Mullen. You know, they're trying to money ball it, but we'll. I think talent wise, yes, Cal is superior.
I will say I pulled a Cal staffer once I kind of came up with this thing. I was like, so what's like the internal expectation? And he said that the, like, spoken expectation is 20 games, excuse me. But the, like, what would you be happy with is probably 17.
I mean, that's – if they go 8-3 in the non-con like you were saying, then that would be 9-11 in Pac-12 play.
Yeah. I mean,
that's certainly a success, I think.
I mean, if they do that, they should probably get National Coach of the Year votes. They shouldn't win it, but they should get votes.
Yeah, I'm trying to think if I'm predicting any other like huge jump. I mean, I guess for me, if like Vanderbilt made the tournament, you give it to Stackhouse or something. But I mean, they we're not too far removed from Vanderbilt making the tournament all the time. With
so I saw. I mean, I don't. We don't need to go back to Stackhouse too much, but I saw someone today. Like there was a. One of the stupid like CBK reports of the world tweeted a like ranking of SEC coaches, and he said Stackhouse is like ninth, and some like Tennessee fan jumped in and was like, Stackhouse is way too low, like he's way better than that, like I don't know how you know, this is a terrible list, whatever. And I was like, okay, like I understand people think he's a good coach, but like unless we believe that Vanderbilt is like a legitimately impossible job. Like unless Vanderbilt is like one of the worst jobs in the country, saying that the guy who's never made the NCAA tournament as a head coach is the ninth best coach and like maybe the best coaches league in the country, it's like that felt high to me.
I mean, if right, so I for an exercise, I was ranking all the high major coaches. The SEC, I think almost unequivocally, has 7 of the top 20 coaches in college basketball.
Nate Oates, Eric Musselman, Bruce Pearl, John Calipari, Dennis Gates.
I didn't go Gates. I went
Chris Beard. Rick Barnes. Beard,
Barnes and Buzz.
I would probably push back a little with Buzz, but the track record of winning at most places is fair.
I mean, he did it at Marquette. He totally rebuilt Tech, and then he's totally rebuilt A&M, where, you know, I think everyone has them as a top 20 team this year.
Yeah, he hasn't won a tournament game at Texas A&M, and this is year 5. So I have a hard time saying that guy's a top 20 coach in the country.
But, like, if not, then is Buzz Williams a better coach than Kevin Willard and Ed Cooley and...
I mean, I would take Brad Underwood over Buzz Williams.
Okay.
Maybe that's me over-inflating Underwood. I know people don't like Underwood. I'm a big
Underwood. Big Ten has a lot of, like, good, not great coaches.
Oh, yeah.
And then there are a lot of these guys now who have done well with the limited track records and are getting all the buzz, like Dennis Gates, Micah Shrewsbury.
TJ Osberger.
You could even throw Chris Jans in there, right? Like... guys who have turned it in a year or two, and we need more of a track record, but they have a lot of buzz.
Yeah.
Let's see. Oh, I think Kenny Payne gets fired midseason. No, I should have probably looked at the buyout numbers before I proclaimed that, and if the dates are publicly available or anything, but I think we're gonna get more like embarrassing by game losses, and gonna get to the point where they just cut bait midseason as a symbolic gesture.
I think that's reasonable. I think a like humorous adjacent hot take is that Kenny Payne becomes what has to be the first high major coach ever to move up 100 spots in KenPom and still get fired for performance.
I mean, I don't know where they finished, but they were in the 300s for a lot of the year.
Let me look. I have it on my sheet right here. Standings, ACC. I think they finished like 290. Exactly 290, yeah. So, yeah, they could be like 170. That's still like embarrassing for Louisville.
It's embarrassing for any high major team to be 170.
I'm not so convinced that they'll do it like midseason, like January midseason. I do think that he will not. Let me put it this: I don't think he'll coach in the conference tournament. Like, I think they'll jump the shark, fire him like late Feb, and get a head start of the market.
UCLA fired Steve Alford in what, like January?
Yeah.
And then we had a couple quits. We had the quits and or mutualness with Mark Turgeon and Chris Mack recently.
Have we discussed my galaxy brain Chris Collins to Louisville discussion?
No.
So, like, we already know that the coaching market is very difficult, right? Not a lot of, like, sitting high major head coaches available who go to jobs, right? That's why Louisville is hiring Kenny Payne in the first place. That's why, you know, Syracuse, Duke, North Carolina, all these things have guys with no coaching experience. Villanova. So Northwestern, let's say Chris Collins makes the NCAA tournament again this year at Northwestern. He's made it 2 years in a row. It makes all the sense in the world for him to try to get out, given that Boo Boo will be leaving. Like, it'll be time to like rebuild. Here's this Duke guy with amazing pedigree, who's the only guy who's ever won at this shitty job. Tell me that doesn't like get him in the mix, at least.
I think that Northwestern's not going to be very good this year.
Oh, I agree with you.
Which is going to hurt that. And what's the Louisville-Duke connection? Because Nolan Smith already has 1 foot out the door, it seems.
That's true.
I don't know who they would go to. But, yeah, the issue that I learned soberingly this year, right, is no matter how much you pay your coach, the other high major teams can match it. So unless there's bad blood personally between the AD or the president and the coach, or it's like there's like a real specific reason, like you're probably not going to be able to pick a sitting high major coach.
Correct. Unless it's just like, oh my God, that's their job, right? Like Holtman. People say Holtman would never do Louisville because he grew up a Kentucky fan. But something like that.
I have a few more hot takes. I don't know if you have any more.
Let's bring it home with yours. We don't need a too long episode today.
All right. I think the ACC, in terms of metrics, will come in sixth for the conferences.
Is that hot?
I feel like it is. I'm not sure if they ended up sixth or what last year. Let me pull up T-Rank really quick here.
In KenPom, the ACC was seventh last year.
Same in T-Rank. So maybe this isn't a hot take. Maybe the hot take is that they don't, you know, that wasn't a blip. You know, we went through the coaching ranks last week and how you could argue someone like Micah Shrewsbury or Damon Stoudemire is like on the precipice of being, you know, one of the coaching faces of the ACC between retirements and kind of the back end firings with guys like Brett Brownell and you know, maybe if Boston College doesn't turn or Kenny Payne. And you look at how we think Louisville's going to be terrible. We think Notre Dame's going to be terrible. And I only have four tournament bids. I have Clemson, Syracuse, and NC State pretty close. And, like, Wake Forest pretty close, too. And then of those four, I have Duke as being an elite team. I have Miami around 20-ish. I have UNC at 30 and Virginia at 33. So the top isn't bringing them up too much. The bottom's going to weigh them down, I think. At least the very bottom. And there's going to be enough like teams between like 60 and 80 where I think the Pac-12 can beat them out.
Yeah, I think that's a reasonable enough take. I guess we can include this now because we didn't get a chance to dish on it last week on the pod. The SMU, Cal, Stanford.
Oh, yeah.
it's a good kind of time for it. I wrote this for SI. The ACC is a, like, basketball powerhouse.
It's dead.
It's over.
SMU?
Those three schools have no history in basketball, other than Stanford, who has a little bit. But Stanford is like
not walking through that door.
And Stanford is the most cooked of the three because their dean of students doesn't care at all about athletics and won't let anyone in. So, all three of these teams also have like no fan support. All three had fewer than 4,000 fans a game at last year's, you know, for last year's average attendance. So yeah, it's a bad spot.
SMU is the most ridiculous.
Well, I understand that the moves make perfect sense for like what the ACC needed, right? Like once you stop thinking about conference realignment, it's like we need to consolidate the best schools, we need to do this, we need to do that, and entirely as like a strategic play for, you know, it's basically like a game of imperialism, right? Like once you think about it like that, then it all pieces together, right? Because you know, the ACC didn't expand 2 years ago when the Big 12 took those schools because the ACC said we already don't have enough money to go around. Why would we cut up the pie even more? So, and none of those schools would have wanted to come for a reduced share. So the Big 12, they needed schools. They took the schools at reduced shares or at slightly reduced shares or close to full freight. So let's build. Now, 2 years later, the ACC needs schools because, one, they need to be protected in case Florida State and Clemson leave. Number two, they need to the schools were willing to come for, like, no money. So you might as well take them. That made money for the league, right? Like, the Big 12's moves were stability moves, right? You get the 12, you get 12 and then eventually 16 schools. Now you're like this locked in group that's stably the number three conference. The Big Tens and the SECs were kind of manifest destiny, and the ACCs were survival. And because the Pac-12 didn't expand, the Pac-12 did not survive. So the ACC said, we're not going to be the same thing as Pac-12. We're going to expand. We're going to survive. I get it. But one, the league is way worse in basketball today than it was a week ago. Number two, You may have just accelerated the timeline that North Carolina leaves the ACC. And when you do that, you accelerate the timeline for Duke and Carolina to no longer be in the same conference. And also accelerate the timeline for the like true oh shit moment of like, what have we done to college sports?
So like the ACC in the future ACC that their brave leaders have just insulated themselves for, right? Like they added these teams as mostly we're saying an insurance of when the big boys leave, we'll still be okay.
Well, I think it's twofold, right? It's a little more revenue that they can try to use to keep the big boys happy a little longer, right? Delay the inevitable.
Right, but how much, right? Because so it's $30 million.
So the league. So here's my understanding. the league gets $72 million additional dollars from ESPN, $24 million per school that's added, because these conferences all have these conferences all have pro rata agreements in, basically saying that, like, if we add schools, you have to pay us at the same rate as you pay our other schools. So now for the rest of the TV contract, the ACC gets, you know, this year it's $24 million a year from ESPN per school. Next year, you know, 26, whatever. So ESPN, you know, the ACC takes that money. They say, well, we're not actually giving it to Stanford, Cal, and SMU. SMU, you're getting nothing. Stanford and Cal, you're getting like $8 to $10 million a year. And we're taking the rest, which is a pool of about $50 million, $50 to $55 million from what I've been told, from what I've seen reported, excuse me. And we're going to divide that up. We're going to give a few of it per to each school per year for travel costs. So we'll divide up amongst the other 15 schools. We give them each $2 million. That means we just wiped away 30 of it. Now we got 25 left. What if we give $10 million to the ACC football champion, $10 million to the ACC men's basketball champion, and $5 million to the team who gets the biggest TV ratings? Okay, well, if Florida State wins football and wins the TV ratings war, they get $15 million. So now their shortfall compared to the SEC, instead of $30 million, is 15. Maybe that's a little bit more tolerable for the time being.
It doesn't seem right, but you're still so much shorter than the SEC money and the Big Ten money, and you're less prestigious to the fact that when they can go, they're still going to go.
Right. Well, they need a place to go.
Left with a conference that has SMU, Cal, Stanford, and Syracuse, and Pitt, and Georgia Tech, and Boston College, and Wake Forest, is going to be just like this nonsense conference.
But at that point, there will be a larger blow-up, is I think the bet.
If they're betting on a larger blow-up, then why add them in the first place?
For temporary stability.
For me, and I was reading up a lot about, you know, the move and its effects and the machinations and everything. It seemed like a completely nonsensical panic move. Like, I get the reasons that we just went through about the reduced shares and everything, but we're just rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic. You know, like, you're paying off your credit card debt and you're not even making the minimum payment.
Right, well, right. It's really like you transferred it to a different credit card. Yeah.
Yeah.
You might have, like, dropped the interest rate, but you still owe fucking, you know, you're still too big in a hole to figure it out.
You're still paying more and more interest every year. Let's see. This is kind of hot, I think. And, I mean, we've touched on this enough, so if you want, we can just log this and move on, but I think if Memphis doesn't have DeAndre Williams, they're not making the tournament. Which, from everything else that I've seen and read, that's a scorching hot take. But
I feel very strong. I don't think that's crazy. I will say, like, it'd be nice to know. Like, poor DeAndre's probably still taking classes. Like, what's he doing?
Similarly, I think San Diego State is outside the top 30. Now, we went through a few shows ago how we're not buying it. It seems like there are some people who are ranking them outside the top 25. I think The Athletic did this. San Diego State gets, you know, fans get mad, and I think Sam Vecenie was like, yeah, but they're like 28th in our rankings or whatever. I think they're even a little lower than that, I think. And we went through it that their defense is not the same, and this isn't an offensive juggernaut. So I have them at 34. It might actually be too high, but where I land on San Diego State. Should I keep going? Have anything else?
I have nothing. Go for it.
I don't know if we touched on this over text or on the show, but the more I think about it, the more I just can't get out of my head, is that Jaden Epps leads the Big East in scoring. And now, you might say, well, that's a little contradictory if you have Donovan Clingan winning Big East Player of the Year. I mean, look at the numbers Edie put up. If you think he's going to be Edie, then yeah. But like, what? Like, maybe Klingon can get like 18-ish points a game, and what if Jaden Epps gets like 20 points a game? Like, we know when Cooley has good players, he runs them into the ground. He plays them 40 minutes. You know, Bryce Cotton, Ladante Henton, Ben Bantil. You know, some of these guys who average north of 20 points a game for Cooley. For whatever reason, right? 1 year it was Chris Dunn got hurt, so Bryce Cotton got to play the whole game. Pascal Chukwu transferred, Ben Bentzel got to play the whole game. They needed Henton out there, and Fortune transferred. He gets to play a whole game. The player that gets anointed play the whole game for Cooley doesn't have to play defense. So Epps, I could easily see, you know, he's a scoring guard. He's the best player on the team. They're not going to be very good. I could see him putting up 20, 21 points a game this year. And I'm still not even sure he's like a top 20 player in the conference. I know he's not a top 20 player in the conference. But I think he could put up 20 points a game. Is that too far?
I don't think it's too far. I think he's talented enough to score like 18.
I mean, the Big East has a ton of really good players. And, like, you don't – like maybe the best individual top-end talent of any conference in the country, which is not really apparent until you start breaking it down. And you're, like, artificially moving down guys like Tristan Newton and Oso just because, like, you – and Devin Carter just because you have so many Big East players up at the top already. But, yeah, I can't get that thought out of my head.
I'll give you like absolute like scorcher, and then we'll just end the podcast abruptly. Sky Clark leads the ACC in scoring. It's not that crazy.
I think Trey White leads Louisville in scoring, though. So
everyone says that Sky Clark's Louisville's best player.
Oh, I was listening to Vicini's podcast last week. From when Trenton Flowers left, and he was saying he heard that Trey White was like by far the best player, and that Trenton Flowers was actually not playing well.
Yes,
which makes more sense than Trenton Flowers' story of being the first player in the history of basketball to be unhappy with being the best player on the team.
But, oh well. Well. Hopefully people enjoyed some of these takes. We will have more of them, I'm sure, throughout the preview season. We have some conference previews, hopefully, in a couple weeks. Some big picture stuff as well. Appreciate you all listening, and we will see you all soon.